Oh, okay, love. Sorry about that. It's awful, isn't it? I forgot you might have met them. I can't recall the names, but a young couple. Very sweet looking. There was a picture. Sad for the family. Yes, I was saying to Margaret, so lucky you weren't out there then. Very sad. But I don't want to spoil your nice memories. Sounds like you both had such a lovely time. Bring up the photos at Christmas, will you? I'd love to see them all.
Yes, definitely. Will do. There's a natural pause and I grab it. Look, Susan, I should go. Sorry, it's just I've left some pasta on and Mark's left the kitchen. Can Mark call you tomorrow? Mark raises an eyebrow regarding the pasta. I shrug. What else can I say?
Of course, love. Don't let me keep you. Yes, tell him I'm around in the evening tomorrow. I've got bridge in the morning, so late afternoon. Lovely. Bye then, love.
Bye. I hang up and explode. Fuck! Come and take a look. I plop down next to him on the sofa, and we scan the articles in horror. British couple killed in scuba diving incident in Bora Bora, The Guardian. Death in Paradise, The Mail on Sunday. Brit's scuba death tragedy, The Sun. It's not front page stuff, but most of the papers have covered it. Brit's scuba death tragedy. A British couple drowns while scuba diving together in Bora Bora after panicking underwater and removing their breathing gear. A British couple has died in a tragic scuba diving accident while on holiday in the French Polynesian island of Bora Bora this week. Daniel, 35, and Sally Sharp, 32, died after the accident off the luxury resort island of Bora Bora. The couple were diving together along with their hotel resort dive instructor in the world-renowned scuba spot in the South Pacific when the incident occurred. According to eyewitnesses, the couple panicked, removing their breathing gear while 18 meters underwater at the Four Seasons dive site. A police spokesperson for the island said the couple had swallowed mouthfuls of seawater, while an autopsy later showed their lungs were also filled with water. There were no signs of foul play, a local news website reported. The medical examiner's office examined the equipment worn by the couple, and experts concluded there were no problems with any of the dive equipment, but that both of the Brits' primary air tanks were empty. While their secondary tanks did have air, the Sharps were unable to access them in their panicked state, authorities explained. The incident unfolded on the afternoon of Saturday, September the 17th, 9 days into the tragic young couple's planned two-week trip. Problems began 10 minutes into the half-hour dive when Investec's UK fund manager Sally noticed her oxygen gauge had swung into the red zone and signalled to the dive leader that she was out of air. It was at this stage Conrado Tenaghelli, 31, the resort's dive instructor, tried to intervene. But it soon became apparent that Sally's husband, Daniel Sharp, was also experiencing trouble. The instructor was unable to assist both divers simultaneously, and panic quickly took hold, as the couple, realizing the desperate situation unfolding, fumbled with their own equipment. Eyewitness accounts from other dive group members stated that things escalated fast. According to fellow diver Kazia Vesely, 29, at some point the masks of both divers came completely off because they were struggling, which may have caused both to panic further. The instructor tried to rectify the situation, but it quickly spiraled out of control. We all started to panic too, the other divers, because we didn't know what we were supposed to do either. We didn't know what was happening. We thought there might be something wrong with all our tanks, so we broke off and ascended to call for help from the boat. The instructor signaled us to ascend slowly because we were all panicky. It was really scary, Kazia told local news agencies. First responders at the scene were unable to revive the two tourists. Both were declared dead on arrival at the Vaitap Medical Center. The British Embassy in the French Polynesian capital of Papeete said it was providing consular support to the family. Bora Bora is a major international tourist destination, famous for its aqua-centric luxury resorts. The location is a favorite amongst honeymooners and the jet set alike, with celebrity couples such as Jennifer Aniston and Justin Theroux, Benedict Cumberbatch and Sophie Hunter, Nicole Kidman and Keith Urban, and the Kardashian clan all flocking to its luxury hotels. The resort also attracts divers from all around the world, eager to see the island's tropical wildlife. The dive site where the couple met their tragic end is an area described as suitable for divers of all experience levels. according to the International Dive Directory. The directory says the site in question has hardly any current and a maximum depth of 18 meters, the deepest you can go without a PADI advanced open water or equivalent diving license. Mark and I sit in silence, stunned. Oh my fucking God. The couple from the hike, the nice young couple from our hike, are dead. And the way they died. Utterly horrific. I catch an echo of the panic they must have felt. Fuck. I push it down, away. The question hangs in the air. Two questions, actually. We're both thinking it. Were they murdered? Did someone tamper with their diving gear? What do you think? I finally break the thick atmosphere. We're sitting in the darkness, the half-light of the screen illuminating our pale faces. Could be an accident, he says. I'm not sure whether it's a question or a statement. A couple in their 30s are dead, in our resort, 3 days after I accessed the Plain People's email account, 2 days after we left the island. Is it, Mark? I want it to be an accident. Tell me it's an accident, please. He looks at me. There's doubt in his eyes, but he's thinking it through. Look, diving accidents aren't unusual. Sure, it's a huge coincidence, the timing and place, but that doesn't mean they were definitely murdered. The police are saying no foul play, right? Their whole island economy is based on tourism, Mark. They're not going to tell the press that tourists get murdered out there. No, fair enough, but come on, it's not the easiest way to kill someone, is it? By empty oxygen tank. I mean, anyone on the dive could have ended up with those tanks. They could have just not panicked and used their secondary tanks and just dealt with it, couldn't they? What if they'd just done that? They wouldn't be dead, would they? It doesn't really strike me as a targeted attack, does it? He's starting to believe himself now. He's getting into it. And he does have a point. It is a fairly blunt murder weapon, an empty oxygen tank. But they, the Plain People, if they were there, they probably watched them, Mark. They probably knew the sharps couldn't dive. They might have watched them do their pool training. We don't know. They must have done this before. Made things look like accidents. It feels weird saying the sharp surname out loud. I wish I hadn't. It hangs in the air of our home, strange and cumbersome. We really didn't know them, who they were. The idea of them feels odd and unwieldy. These two dead people we shared memories with. Strangers, but like us. Young, British, on honeymoon. Surrogate uses. Like us, but dead. I remember them from the resort. We were only on nodding terms, small talk. Then again, they'd only been there 3 days and we'd already found the bag. We weren't really paying attention. Mark breaks the silence. I just don't think someone did this, Erin. I don't. It's beyond odd that this has happened. I won't argue with that. But why didn't they just kill them? If someone wanted to kill them. I mean, come on, it's a bit convoluted, isn't it, honey? Why not do it in their sleep or poison or, I don't know. If these people are as rich and powerful as we think they are, why do it like that? And why the sharps? Christ, they don't even look like us. He's completely convinced now. But one little thing keeps niggling at me. Mark, how would they know it was a couple that found the bag? And then another thought strikes me. How would they know to look for a British couple, Mark? The fear rises in me, because how would they know? Unless we left a trail, did I miss something? Did I leave some crucial piece of evidence behind? Mark slowly closes his eyes. He knows why. Oh God, there's something he hasn't told me. What is it, Mark? Tell me. I'm not messing around now. I'm up on my feet. I bang on the light switch, flooding the room with light. He squints up at me, momentarily blinded. Sit down, Erin. It's fine. Please, honey. He pats the seat cushion next to him wearily. This is a conversation he never wanted to have. I give him a hard look before sitting down next to him. This had better be good. He rubs his face and leans back with a deep sigh. Oh, fuck. Okay, here it is. When I went back at the hotel in Bora Bora, when I went back to erase the check-in info from their system, slash look for your earring, he blows out hard through his mouth. Shit. I ran into the water sports guy. He looks at me. Paco, I say. He nods. Yeah. He asked if we got our bag back. Shit. He said one of the porters had mentioned we'd left our bag by the boat. Paco wondered if we got it back in the end. I guess the porter we left it with must have totally misunderstood. What did you do, Mark? I demand. But I don't really want to hear the answer, because if I hear it, it will make it real. I had to say something, so I don't know, I was thinking on my feet. I didn't, you know, think through the implications or whatever. It just came out. I say nothing. I wait. I asked Paco what he was talking about and acted confused, and then suddenly remembered that the other British couple, the Sharps, I think they were called, had mentioned something about a bag on our hike. Something about finding a bag or something. The porter must have mixed us up, I told him. I said it was funny that he'd confused us because we'd had a similar problem before. It must be our accents, I said. And he laughed, and we left it at that. When he stopped speaking, the silence floods the room again. We're submerged in it. And now they're dead, I say. And now they're dead, Mark echoes. We let that and all its implications sink in. Either the Sharps had a diving accident, or they were killed because someone thought they were us. We might have killed two people. Why did you say it? I ask with half-hearted intensity, because I know he couldn't possibly have known this would happen, could he? I would have done the same thing, put on the spot like that, wouldn't I? He shakes his head. I don't know. I just did. He rubs his face again and groans. Do you think it was them? Do you think they killed them? He drops his hand and stares at me now, sober, focused. Honestly? Honestly, Erin, there's no way of knowing. But it's a pretty elaborate way to kill someone. It could definitely have just been an accident. But, and I know this is awful, but if they were murdered, as terrible as it is, nobody will be looking for us now. As awful as that may sound, if it was deliberate, if they did come looking for and then killed the couple that found the bag, then it's finished, isn't it? The couple is dead. They couldn't find the missing bag. It's finished. We're safe. I made a mistake, definitely, but I'm glad with all my heart it wasn't us, Erin. I'm glad no one is coming for us. There's finality to what he says. He takes my hand in his, and I look down at our tightly gripped fists. He's right. I'm glad it wasn't us too. We're dead. They think we're dead. And bizarrely, for just a second, it does make me feel safer. I'm almost certain we left no trace. But that's the thing about slip-ups, isn't it? You don't know you've made one. I hear what Mark's saying, but in my heart I know, I just know, that they are still looking for us. Maybe we should call the police. But I don't say it out loud. Mark has made up his mind no one is coming for us. He can tell me in a million different ways that it's over now, but I won't really hear them. I'll know they're coming for a long time yet, so I don't pursue it. I let it go. I'll have to come to his conclusion on my own, or not at all. I nod. You're right, I say. He wraps his solid arms around me, and pulls me close in the silence of our home. Chapter 25, Monday, September the 19th, Holly's follow-up. I press the entry buzzer. Phil and I are standing outside the entrance of Holly Byford's council block, or rather, Holly's mother's council block. It's raining a thin, persistent mist that coats our clothes and hair, not heavy enough for an umbrella, but continuous enough to chill me to the bone. I'm still in that delicate post-vacation period right now, where I know I'm going to come down with something. It's just a matter of time. Standing here in the rain might just do it. I'm following our plan. The plan to carry on like normal. So here I am, being normal. I look out across the grassy wasteland surrounding the council estate. What I hazard a guess may be called the communal gardens. I woke up this morning thinking about the Sharps. I've been trying not to, but they're lurking in my mind, just out of sight. Flashes of the panic, bubbles in the water, and then two pale waterlogged corpses on stainless steel slabs. Our fault. I feel as if I'm being watched. I have since we left the island, but more so since yesterday's news. I scan the bleak buildings and grounds for a source, but we appear to be of little interest to the locals. No one is watching. If whoever killed the Sharps has tracked us down somehow, if they're following us, they're not letting on yet. Of course, this feeling of being observed could be something else entirely. I think of the chilled champagne we drank in Bora Bora. Was it only a week ago? Champagne sent from the other side of the world. Eddie is interested in me too, isn't he? Might he have someone following me now that I'm back, checking up on me, watching? I let my eyes wander across the complex. There's a young white guy pacing near the car park, a phone pressed to his ear. A black guy sitting in his work van about to leave. An old lady entering the building opposite, wheelie shopping bag in tow. No one suspicious. No one who looks like a killer. Nobody has found me. I'm just a damp woman waiting for someone to answer a buzzer. I look up at the hundreds of windows reflecting grey sky back down onto us. So many windows. So far from the plain at the bottom of the South Pacific Ocean. I push the buzzer again. A long, slow push. Phil sighs. The camera is fucking heavy. I don't blame him. It's 9 a.m. They should definitely be up by now. I've been up since dawn, and I can safely say this is not my idea of easing gently back into work. Today is going to be a slog. From the little I've seen of Holly, I already know this will be exhausting. But in the words of Murakami, the master of the hard slog, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. I press the buzzer again.
What? What the fuck do you want? What?
The voice crackles through the metal grate of the entry system, abrupt and aggressive. It's female, older than Holly, gruffer, huskier. I'd venture a guess we've woken up Mrs. Byford. I hold down the buzzer and speak. Hi there, is that Michelle Byford? This is Erin Roberts. I'm here to see Holly. We're supposed to be meeting her here at 9 to film. I hear myself and flinch inside. I know what people hear when they hear my voice. They hear privilege and condescension and bleeding heart liberalism. God, I'm in a funk today. Daniel and Sally Sharp creep around my head. Get it together, Erin. Silence. Phil sighs again.
Oh, right.
The tone has changed. Resigned now.
Guess you better come up then,
she mutters, annoyed. The door buzzes, clunks, and we push in. I've told Phil what to expect here, but there's only so much you can relay. It's more of a general feeling you get from Holly than anything else. Her stare, her smile. He's watched the first interview, so I'm sure he's picked up on that too. Anyway, he's been warned. Don't get dragged into anything. The Byford flat is on the 6th floor, and predictably, the lift is out of order. I'd be surprised if Phil has the energy to be dragged into anything after lugging the camera up 6 flights of stairs. Michelle's standing out in the communal hallway, in furry slippers, powder blue robe, and a, but first give me coffee, pajama set, scowling at us. She's clearly just got out of bed. No sign of Holly. Perhaps she's still asleep. Michelle looks exhausted. My notes say she works full-time in a department store. 15 years. Ever since Holly's dad left. Not to be rude, but shouldn't she be at work by now? Hi, Michelle. Lovely to meet you. Sorry for the early start, I say. And to my surprise, she takes my hand and shakes it. A distracted smile. She seems worried about something. I suppose you better go ahead and turn that on first. She gestures to Phil's camera. Phil and I share a look, and the camera is up on his shoulder, red light on. I just don't want to say it all twice. Michelle looks at me and frowns to herself. You better come in. I'll stick the kettle on. She shuffles in her pink booties into the linoleum-tiled flat. We follow. I'm starting to get the feeling that Holly isn't in there. Michelle busies herself about the narrow kitchen space.
I've got to call the police if anyone comes asking questions, that's the thing. So you mind if I quickly call them up now?
She seems embarrassed. A woman forced into following the rules she hasn't signed up for. I shake my head, I don't mind. But the word police screams through my head. Police is not a word I wanted or expected to hear today. I'm sorry, Michelle. I really have no idea what's going on here. Has something happened? I look back at Phil, in case he's figured it out. Have I missed something? For a fraction of a second, I think she might actually be calling the police because of me. Because of the plane, because of the Sharps. But that's absurd, of course. Michelle doesn't know. She doesn't know me from Adam. And any brief impulse I felt yesterday to call the police after finding out about the Sharps has long since evaporated. Involving the police at this stage would definitely not be a good idea. Michelle holds up a finger, phone to her ear. Wait.
Hi there, it's Michelle Byford. Can I speak to Andy, please?
There's another pause as we all wait, suspended, like the stale cigarette smoke in the kitchen air.
Thanks. Hello, hi Andy, yes, good thanks. No, I haven't, no, nothing like that. But I've got some people here in the flat now asking about Holly. No, nothing like that. Yes, I know.
She laughs nervously.
No, they're from the prison charity. They interviewed Holly in prison for a film. Yes. Erin, yes.
My eyes shoot to Phil at the mention of my name. This police officer she's talking to knows me. He knows of me. What the fuck is going on? Michelle holds up a finger. Wait.
Yes, and a man.
She doesn't know Phil's name. We skipped that formality. Phil. Phil supplies, the cameraman. Pithy as ever.
Phil, the cameraman. Yes, I'll tell them. One second, right. Here in 10:15. Okay, one second.
She holds the phone away from her face and addresses us.
Andy says, would you mind waiting 10-15 minutes and he'll swing by? He wants to ask you a couple of questions if he can.
I look back at Phil. He shrugs. Sure. I answer. What else can I do? Say no? No, I'm afraid I can't actually stay and talk to the police, Michelle, because I've just stolen $2 million and maybe caused the deaths of 2 innocent people. I think my only move here is to just stay. Stay and try to act normal. Sure, just about covers it. First day back at work, and I'm already being questioned by the police. My stomach rolls. Michelle puts the phone back to her ear and addresses Andy. It's becoming clear to me what's going on here. I credit myself that much. I'm guessing Holly's skipped parole. That's what it will be, something like that. But for some reason, my palms are sweating. Michelle continues into the phone.
Andy, yes, that's all fine. They'll be here. No, I don't think they do. Of course I will. Yes. Okay then. I'll see you soon. Okay then, bye.
She hangs up and smiles down at the inanimate phone. At Andy, I'd imagine, in an office somewhere. Phil and I wait. Finally she looks up.
Sorry about that. Coffee?
She flicks on the kettle and it roars to life, recently boiled.
Okay, right, sorry. I suppose you've guessed Holly's not here.
Michelle looks between us, businesslike. We have. She nods.
Yeah, she left yesterday. Just disappeared. I took her some toast in bed in the morning, but she wasn't there. We've been looking since. We don't know where she is at the moment. Police are working on it. Andy's heading up the search right now. It's...
She breaks off and stares out the grimy double-glazed window above her sink. The kettle clicks off and bubbles to silence next to her. She snaps back into the room and smiles.
Let's have a sit down, shall we?
She places the coffee mugs down with ceremony onto the pine fold-leaf table and we sit. Phil continues to film her as she sips her steaming mug. According to the mug's inscription, coffee makes my day more beautiful. I do hope so. It doesn't seem to be going very well so far, for any of us. I peer down at the grey-brown stew before me, pellets of undissolved coffee still clinging for dear life to the white ceramic of my mug. Shit, this is not a good situation. I could really do with not being here right now. I think of the bag hidden in our attic, and guilt, like the first domino, starts to topple one mistake into another. I need to center myself. I need to lock this feeling down before Andy, the policeman, gets here. And where the hell is Holly? Michelle sets her mug down carefully with two hands and explains.
Okay, here's what we know.
She looks up with the certainty of someone towing the official line. She's been over this a dozen times already, up all night. I can tell. She has that look. I've interviewed a lot of people so far in my career, and she's been over these calls a few times. And now she's doing it again, for us.
So, I met Holly, collected her, you know, out of the back of the prison, around 8 a.m. on the 12th of September. That was 7 days ago. She spent the week in the flat mainly, watching TV, napping. I don't think she got much sleep in prison. She was exhausted. Then, day before yesterday, Saturday, we'd arranged to nip round to Sinead's flat. She's a friend from work. She used to be a hairdresser, so she could sort out Holly's hair. Holly had been worried about her highlights in jail, and Sinead said she'd do them for free. So we went there. I bought us some other clothes, Adidas stuff. They all love that now.
She smiles, a mother in the know.
And she changed into them. And then after that, we went to Nando's for chicken. She was desperate for Nando's, on about it forever. Really excited about bleeding Nando's. I don't think the food was up to much in prison, you know. She was stick thin when she got home.
Well, you saw her, you know yourself.
Anyway, she loved it. Had a half chicken and one each of all the sides. She was happy as a clam. Then we came home and she said she wanted to make a couple of calls on her laptop. So she went in her room and did that for a while. And then we watched some old episodes of the Kardashians on catch up. She was pretty tired and went to bed around 9. Nothing out of the ordinary. She seemed happy, like her old self again. And then I went into her room yesterday morning and she was gone. I only took a couple of things. No note, nothing. But I told Andy she did take one thing. Photo of us, me and her. The one she had in prison. She always kept it by her bed. She liked that photo. Said it made her happy whenever she missed me. She didn't say stuff like that very often. So I remember it.
Michelle looks at us. That's all she's got. That's her side of it. Do you know where she might have gone? I ask. She looks down at her mug and tuts.
No, not for certain. There's a theory. The police are looking into it. And to be honest, I'm not sure how much they're telling me about it all. Andy's part of SO15, so it's a bit tricky finding out anything from them, really. I don't know if you know all about that sort of thing. Counter-terrorism stuff.
It comes so out of the blue that I almost laugh. Almost. Phil looks over. SO15? Fucking hell. I check Michelle's face, but it's blank. Drawn and tired. She's not joking. I shake my head. No. I know nothing about counter-terrorism, obviously.
I find it very hard to believe my Holly would be involved in any of this. She's never been involved in anything like that. Never ever mentioned God or any sort of religion. Andy's lovely, but he's wrong about this. I do trust him, but I don't know. He'll get her back, and that's the most important thing. That's all that matters.
Michelle grabs a crumpled cigarette packet from her robe pocket and fumbles one out. I think fleetingly of the pregnancy test, the blue cross, as her lighter flashes and a fresh wave of smoke fills the tiny room. Michelle looks across the table at us both now, leans forward on her elbows.
Holly's not the brightest, you know. She's all mouth for sure, but she's easily led. Always has been. It's competitive, you know. Just a competitive streak. I'm tougher than you, I can do it better than you, you know. But the it could be anything. It could be dares or setting that bus on fire or whatever. She likes the drama of it. It's just showing off. That's all it is. She's always been that way. It's just more extreme these days. The older she gets, the further she goes. I know it's probably my fault. Her dad wasn't a great example, and then she fell in with Asher, and that lot. It's strange. Ash was such a good boy at school. Nice Turkish family. I met his mum once. I just don't understand it. Maybe I should have been around more. But someone had to work. Her dad certainly wasn't going to.
She stops herself. She's gone down the wrong track. She's gotten lost in her own tunnels and dragged us with her. She needs to head back to daylight.
Did Holly go alone? I ask.
Or with someone?
It's the next logical question, but I think I already know the answer.
With Esh, at Eshar, she corrects herself.
I nod. It's coming together now. Ash was Holly's friend from the bus video. It's not guilt in Michelle's tone, but self-absolution. None of this is her fault. What could she have done to stop them? It's Holly and Ash. In her mind, the blame is halved. It's just the kids messing around. The threat's not real in her eyes. Just two kids who may have gone a little bit too far this time. Of course, it's impossible not to infer what's happened here. The pieces fall into place like the first level of Tetris. I'm sure SO15 Andy will enlighten us further once he arrives, but beyond a doubt, he will not allow us to film him. We need to get as much footage as I can before he arrives. That's clear. Before we're asked to stop. I stand up and take charge, changing the energy in the cramped flat. Michelle, we need to take a look at her room now. Film in there. It's not a question. I'm not asking her. My directing brain has kicked in, and we need more for the film. As much as I can smash and grab. Look, I don't want to take advantage of her, but it's clear Michelle trusts and responds well to authority. If she feels it's for the best, then we'll get what we need. I want that footage of the room for the film, and we're getting it. I hold her gaze slightly too long, deliberately. She looks away. And it works. She rises, cowed.
Yes, yes, of course. The police searched it already and took all their own pictures, so I'm sure it's fine to do what you need to do in there.
She stares back up at me, searching for approval, reassurance. She wants us to know she's helping, that she's not going to be a problem like Holly. She leads us out of the kitchen and down the hall. Phil throws me what I assume is meant to be an accusing glance. He didn't like that. What I just did. It wasn't like me. It was cruel. Fuck it. I'm not sure I care today. I'm not feeling myself, whatever that means. I'm not even sure who I am anymore. Maybe I died in the South Pacific with Sally Sharp. Holly's room is small, teenaged, basic. Phil scans it slowly with the camera. Magazine pictures blue-tacked to the walls, hard-eyed fashion models clutching perfume bottles, sexuality, money, glitter stickers, dead flies along the windowsill. A doe-eyed Harry Styles fold-out, Kanye posters, Wu-Tang Clan posters, grandiose, dangerous, a far cry from overcast Croydon. All pre-prison interior design, the faces on the posters sun-bleached after almost 5 years of staring back into an empty room. But I'm looking for other things. I sense Phil is too. Even if he disapproves of my methods, I know he's thinking what I'm thinking. Is there anything religious in this room? Anything at all? I look, but I don't see it. A stack of books by the bed. A Victoria Beckham fashion book. A dog-eared Garfield book. The Power of Now, The Little Book of Calm. The last thing I'd expect Holly to read. But then maybe not. A stab at self-knowledge? Or a gift from a well-meaning mum? Either way, neither of the self-help books looks read. But then who am I to judge? I haven't read them either. And anyway, they definitely aren't the cause of what's happening now. They're not exactly terrorist textbooks. And then it hits me. We won't find anything here. Holly was only 18 when she lived in this room. These are the relics of who she was. She's 23 now. Growing up changes you. 5 years in prison changes you. Who knows what happened to her in that time? I mean, look at me. My whole life has changed in 9 days. I've become a liar and a thief. God knows where or who I'll be in 5 years. Hopefully not in prison. The doorbell chimes and our eyes flick to Michelle. She nods and trots off to let Andy in. Phil lowers the camera. Do you see anything? He whispers. There's a new urgency in his eyes now, too. To him, this documentary just became very interesting. He can already sniff awards in the future. No, I don't think there's anything here, Phil. She'd only been back a week before she left. We need to look elsewhere, Facebook, Twitter, all that. But Holly's not an idiot. Not anymore, anyway. If there's something here, it won't be easy to find. I scan the room again, but I know I'm right on this one. There are no clues here. As we enter the hallway, a stocky man and Michelle are talking quietly by the front door. Andy. He's shorter than I'd imagined, but attractive. There's an easy charm about him as he turns to greet us. The flash of a winning smile. Perhaps that's why he got the job. A people person. Michelle's right, he does inspire trust. I'd say he's early 50s, a good head of hair, an almost illusory whiff of expensive soap. I'm going to have to be extremely careful now. He's clearly very good at what he does. He's playing Michelle like an old pro. I'd hazard a guess that Andy is one of life's winners. I think perhaps everything comes up roses for Andy. Well, let's go, Andy. Let's do this, because I'm not going to prison. I will not lose this fight. I run my hand subtly inside my coat and push gently against my belly. It's okay in there. Mummy's got you. I fix my game face as he steps towards us, smiling. Erin, Phil, I'm Detective Chief Inspector Foster. Call me Andy. Nice to meet you both. Thanks for sticking around. He shakes our hands firmly. We make our way into Michelle's living room, leaving the camera in the hall. Phil's not filming anymore. Phil, Michelle, and I take the sofa, while DCI Andy perches, facing us on a low leather pouf on the other side of the cluttered coffee table. So, I'm not sure how much Michelle's told you, but Holly was on probation after her release. She's violated that by leaving the house, and she's most certainly violated it now by leaving the country. He says it lightly. Fuck. This is a little more serious than I'd hoped. I didn't think it would get that far. Holly's fled the country. He continues. That's one thing. The probation violation is a separate issue, though. The main issue we're facing right now is that we're extremely concerned Holly may be trying to make her way into Syria with Ashar Farouk. That appears to be her plan, both her and Ash's plan. We know she boarded a flight at Stansted Airport 14 hours ago to Istanbul. We've got CCTV footage of them leaving the airport in Istanbul and boarding a bus. It's safe to say we're concerned. So that's where we are. His tone is serious now, businesslike. Syria. This is huge. And the awful truth is, this is a documentarian's wet dream. Events superseding planned narrative structure. Filmmaking heaven. But I definitely do not feel that as I sit here. I see what a great story this could be. I see it. But all I feel now is dread. A barreling wall of horror speeding towards me. This is real. Holly has done something really bad. There will be a full investigation. I am involved. We are all involved. And there is a large bag of loose diamonds under my loft insulation, which will look fairly incriminating if the police decide to search our house. Very incriminating. With every bone in my body, I wish that Holly would just breeze back in through the door, right this moment, sullen and vicious and just be a bit rude to us all. Our job is simple, DCI Foster continues. First, we need to find out where Holly is. Make sure she's safe. If possible, bring her home. Second, we need to find out who she's been associating with, at what stage she became radicalized in prison, and how she managed to leave the UK. That's the information I'm currently interested in. How does he think we can help with that? Now, I want to be clear. In terms of Holly herself, as of now, she hasn't done anything wrong. The probation violation is very small fry compared to the other things at play here. We're not interested in punishing Holly for running away. It's more important to get her home and talking to us about what's gone on. How she managed to obtain her documents, her contacts. We're looking to help her and any other girls like her in this situation. You'll have to trust me when I say this. It's not the place they think it is out there. They tend to target younger girls. Problem girls. Promise great things, and by the time the girls get out there, it's too late to change their minds and they're trapped. Holly's going to find that all out pretty soon, if she hasn't already. They don't care about these girls. They're trophies. They're expendable. Andy looks to Michelle, holds her gaze. Which is why we need to get her home, soon as we can. Michelle's gone quite pale. Her hands fumble a journey down to her cigarette pocket. She's forgotten that she left them on the kitchen table. And for some reason, this thought makes me incredibly sad. Now, Erin, the DCI turns his high beams on me. We weren't aware you were filming this morning. I guess Holly didn't pass that information on to her mother. We've been talking to the guys down at Holloway Prison about your interview footage of Holly. Obviously no one's seen it yet, but we're extremely interested to take a look at it. I think what you have there might be the only up-to-date footage we have of Holly, aside from the CCTV footage, which isn't really helping us, if I'm honest. I've got a lot of departments that are fairly eager to see what you've got. Do you still have the footage? I nod. It's not edited, it's just raw footage at this moment. I haven't gone through it myself yet. I can't say if there's anything that stood out in terms of... That's not a problem, he interrupts. He hands me a card. Detective Chief Inspector Andrew Foster. His number and email. Transfer whatever you've got as soon as you can. No problem. I take the card and make a show of pocketing it safely. Policemen make me nervous. They always have. I feel him searching my face, scanning me for something, anything, a peg to hang guilt on. I struggle to keep my face open, blank. Andy turns to Phil. You weren't present at the interview in Holloway, were you? You never met Holly yourself. No, never met Holly. I'm meeting Alexa tomorrow, he answers unfazed. But then he's not connected to a plane crash, two murders, theft, fraud and smuggling. I think the worst Phil's ever done is smoke the occasional joint, and maybe an illegal download or two. The DCI's gaze shifts back to me. Ah, yes, your documentary, he smiles. I can't quite tell the smile's meaning. Who else is in it again? He knows. He's almost certainly checked. I hold his gaze. Eddie Bishop at Pentonville, Alexa Fuller at Holloway, and Holly, I reel off. Everything is on record. I've got a paper trail to prove it. Andy gives a little nod. It's a good group. I know it's a good group. He turns back to Phil. Anyway, Phil, you're actually okay to knock off early if you want. It's just Erin I need. I don't want to keep you any longer than I have to, so feel free to scarper. A flash of that smile again. Phil eyes me. I nod. I'll be fine. As he leaves, he glances back, eyebrows raised. It's been a weird morning. This documentary could be bigger than either of us imagined. I know it. Phil knows it too. He'll be on his MacBook trawling Holly's social media platforms as soon as he can find a cafe with Wi-Fi. Michelle is sent off by Andy, ostensibly to make more bad coffee. Once she's gone, he leans in towards me, elbows on knees, serious. So, Erin, your time with Holly, did you notice anything? Anything at all that might seem unusual? That might have struck you as odd? Did she mention anything at all? He looks older when he's not smiling. Slacker, beaten down, more like I'd expect a detective to look. I think back to the interview, 2 months ago now. It may as well be a year for all that's happened since. Did I notice anything that might suggest her traveling to the Middle East? Did I? Amal's image flashes in my mind, the prison guard that day. Middle Eastern Amal. Amal meaning hope in Arabic. Amal with the kind eyes. I instantly feel shame. I push the thought away. I'm not that sort of person. I refuse to be that sort of person. Amal is just an average Londoner trying to do his job. He just happens to have an Arabic name. Stop it, Erin. Andy sits waiting for an answer. I wouldn't say anything specific, no. Holly was... she was, you know, slightly unnerving, I'll admit that. I can't say there was anything definitive, but I did get a general feeling from her. I stopped talking. Shit. I replay my words in my head. I probably should have just said, no, nothing, and left it at that. Idiot. I really don't need the scrutiny of being part of a police investigation right now. Mark and I can only stand up to so much background delving before the shit hits the fan. My first retainer payment from my Saudi Arabian shell company will be transferring into my bank account in 8 days. Money from the Middle East, after a girl goes missing, won't look good to a man like DCI Andy Foster. Unnerving? In what way? He looks worried now. I made him concerned. Yes, I seem to have snagged an invisible tripwire. Damn. Just her attitude, you know, in light of her previous crime. The video of her watching things burn, her attitude the day of the interview, she's... again, words fail me. What is she? Sorry, Andy. There's no other way to say it. She's a very creepy girl. Sorry, but there it is. In for a penny, in for a pound. And you know what? If I'm a prejudiced witness, then at least I'll never make it to court. He chuckles. Oh, thank God. His face is light again. I'm just a girl making a documentary. Yeah, I've seen the bus stuff. He nods. We're on the same page again. Creepy's the word, all right, Erin. Creepy, but not bad, I don't think. Just easily led. I hope she has a change of heart before she crosses that border, because once you cross those sorts of lines, there's no way back. We won't be able to help her after that. We won't be looking to bring her back, if you know what I mean. He keeps his voice low. I can hear Michelle puttering about alone in her kitchen, cigarette smoke trailing through to us. He sighs. We share a look. We do what we can, Erin, but some people won't help themselves. I think we're bonding. I think we're getting along. To be fair to Michelle, she has no idea who her daughter is anymore. She couldn't have seen this coming. A prison visit once a week for 5 years does not an attentive mother make. He glances off towards the kitchen. I take the opportunity to swallow. My desire to look like a normal person while under scrutiny has rendered everyday bodily functions tricky. He continues. Holly changed about 5 months before release. We have statements from prison guards and counsellors. 2 things happened around that time. She signed up for the prison charity scheme, and she agreed to take part in your documentary. I can fairly confidently say you're not heading up a London cell of Al-Qaeda, Erin, but I'd lose my job if I didn't follow up a bit. Silence. He's watching me. The hint of a smile plays at the corners of his mouth. So they have been looking into me already. Shit. How much? Am I a suspect? I know you're not supposed to ask, but am I? I feel my cheeks redden. My neck grow hot, my body now officially out of my control. He chuckles, satisfied. No. No, Erin, you're definitely not a suspect. You've never even met Ashar Farouk. Your only meeting with Holly is on film, and all your phone calls to the prison were recorded and monitored at the time. I've listened to them all. Shit. You've done nothing. But you do need to let me have a copy of that footage as soon as possible today, and then we'll be out of your air. We're not interested in you as such, at this stage. Another shadow of a smile. With that he stands and brushes down his trousers. Then he looks up. Oh, and it goes without saying, don't share that footage with anyone else. No news agencies, no press, obviously. And you won't be able to use the footage for your documentary until our investigation is concluded. And you know what? Even then, do me a favour and call me beforehand, okay? Check in. Don't be a stranger. He smiles. It really is a winning smile. He's not bad looking by any stretch of the imagination. Then, I don't know why I say what I say next, but I do. Andy, when it's done, I want to get an exclusive on this, okay? Before anyone else. An interview would be fantastic. There it is. I've nailed my colours to the post. His smile broadens, surprised, amused. Don't see why not, once it's all public record. Couldn't hurt. Sounds like a nice little film you're making, Erin. Interesting. Call me. And with that, he's gone. When I get home, the first thing I do is race up to the attic. Thankfully, Mark isn't home yet. He's meeting old colleagues today, testing the waters for contacts to sell the diamonds to. But in the meantime, the diamonds are still in our attic, and I'm worried about them. Our stash. If they decide to search the house, they will find them. I move an old sewing machine on top of the loose insulation. I sit cross-legged on the splintered floor, agonizing about whether putting the sewing machine over it makes it more noticeable or less. If SO15 searches our house, will a sewing machine draw the eye or hide the loose section of insulation? I googled SO15 on my way home. They're a specialist operations branch of the Met, Counterterrorism Command, a department created from the merger of the special branch and the old anti-terrorist branch. They're serious police. I move the sewing machine off again. There is definitely nowhere in this house the police won't look if they decide I'm of interest. I can't bury the diamonds in the garden now either. The soil would be disturbed and the police love to dig up a patio, don't they? I've seen enough crime dramas to know that. And now there's no chance I can fly to Switzerland and store them in the safety deposit box, not now that I'm part of Andy's investigation. That would raise more flags than anything else. We just need to get this stuff out of our house as soon as we can. That's the only answer. We need to get rid of the diamonds. I think of the plane. The people still down there, strapped in tight, safe in their seats, in the dark nighttime water. I can't help wondering about them. Who were they? Were they bad, like Mark said? Did they look like terrible people? I'm glad I didn't see them. I don't think I would ever forget something like that. It's hard keeping my thoughts at bay as it is. I see faces of my own imagining, grey and waterlogged. I wish there was some way to find out who they were. We tried everything we could think of. We trawled those Interpol and missing persons websites out in Bora Bora. Mark is the only one who would be able to pick them out of a lineup. And he's looked. Maybe I should just ask him to look again. Maybe I should search Russian news sites for missing people. Chapter 26. Tuesday, September the 20th. The Stones. Mark has a contact for the Stones. One of the old work colleagues he met with yesterday while I was filming at Holly's has suggested a possible solution. Just in time. Once the diamonds are sold, we can get the money wired straight to Switzerland and we'll be all done. Our nest egg secured. I haven't told Mark about Holly or DCI Foster. I want to get today out of the way first. I don't want him worrying about the police until this deal is done. I'm certain they're not looking into me yet, and if we get the diamonds sorted today, it's over. I still haven't told Mark about the baby either. I'm not deliberately keeping secrets. I just want to wait until the time is right. It's such big news. I don't want it tarnished by worry. I want it to be special. Pure. I'll tell him once this is done. When we sell the diamonds today, all traces of the bag will be gone. All traces of the plane gone. The diamonds are the last loose end. Mark's contact has come through a girl called Victoria. She was in the same training program as Mark at JP Morgan. She dropped out pretty early, specialized, and now she's a quant trader in the equity algorithmic trading team at HSBC. She's Persian and has a half-brother who advises and trades in tangible assets. That's art and luxury goods, jewelry, Ming vases, Napoleon's hat, that kind of stuff. Only joking, not Napoleon's hat. Well, actually, yeah, maybe Napoleon's hat. Who knows? the liquid assets of the super-rich, whatever form they may take. Victoria's half-brother has a website, Naaman Saadi Art and Asset Advisors. My favourite page on the website is titled Art as Collateral. I wonder what Monet, de Kooning, Pollock, Bacon and Cezanne, being the most liquid of all the assets, would have thought about being collateral. According to the website, in the wake of the international financial crisis, investors have begun to see the benefits of allowing non-monetary assets such as art, yachts, jewelry, and other collectibles into their overall investment portfolios. These tangible assets, however, need expert care and delicate management, not just in the areas of storage, display, preservation, and insurance, but primarily as tradable assets of substantial value. They require the same level of oversight needed by solely financial investment portfolios. Here at Naaman Saadi, we will ensure you achieve and maintain a balanced portfolio by advising and making you, the investor, aware of current market values and advising on when to buy, to sell, or to hold, while assisting at every stage with procurements and sales. Well, there you go. A protective shell of art. Art being used like cigarettes in prison. I suddenly realize the double meaning of oversight. They require the same level of oversight needed by solely financial investment portfolios. One of life's ironies, I suppose. I fear the clients of Naaman Saadi Art and Asset Advisors will be the first against the wall when the revolution comes, collateral or no. Anyway, Mark has asked Victoria to contact her brother Charles for a client of his. They're LinkedIn friends, Mark and Victoria, and after a brief catch-up over coffee, Mark brought it up. Would her brother be interested in meeting a potential new client who's looking to dissolve some assets over the next few months? The idea seemed to go down well. Mark said that she sat up a little taller in the cafe and very much enjoyed playing the role of middleman. Her brother's business had been hit quite hard by the current climate, apparently, and Charles could really use the commission right now. Victoria handed over one of Charles's business cards and told Mark to pass it on to his client. She even thanked Mark for thinking of Charles for it. Mark made the call and set up the meeting. I was to go, not as the client, but as the client's PA, Sarah. So far, so standard. I knew from Caro's stories that most of her gallery sales came over the phone or through personal assistants buying at openings. Why go to buy your own collateral when you can send someone else? I'm meeting Charles this morning. I leave Mark in the Patisserie Valerie at Green Park and make my way alone down onto Pall Mall. The showroom in Pall Mall is discreet. As you enter, it looks more like a high-end private auction house than anything else. Self-contained display plinths pepper the room, housing treasures that I'm guessing probably aren't for sale. Just totems placed to reassure clients that this is the right place for them. Class-related dog whistles, trophies, emblems. But to be fair, I'd imagine everything in here can be bought for the right price. In one case, an Incan death mask glimmers warm in the glow of the spotlights, behind a good inch of thick glass. In another case, a Japanese suit of armor. In another, a necklace with one glistening briolette diamond hanging as thick and fat as a sherbet lemon from a string of lesser diamonds twinkling in the showroom's lights. Charles greets me. He's a healthy, ruddy, well-haired red trouser wearer with a hint of a South of France tan. He appears to be the only one around. Perhaps they only open the shop for meetings. I can't believe there's much foot traffic, even in Pall Mall. We sit nestled at the back of the room, at an oversized mahogany partner's desk. If it's not a Chippendale, it's definitely in the manner of Thomas Chippendale. I guess you're meant to notice these things. I guess that's the point of them. That's probably why they're chosen. We sit and make light small talk, deep inside the thickly carpeted showroom. Charles makes me a pod coffee, and I figure the business conversation ball is in my court. I'm sure Charles could keep the small talk going and divert me all day if I don't cut to the chase. He's definitely not the sort to bring up business first. It wouldn't be done in his trade, I'd imagine, cutting to the chase. Even East End market stall traders love the patter, don't they? Of course, Charles is no market stall trader, let's be clear. He's Oxbridge through and through. Precise, sharp, but riddled with the self-imposed shame of underperforming his own potential. It seems that the one drawback of having every opportunity in life is that you can never fulfill